Thank you, Father Sirico. Getting the panel off to an excellent start. Our next speaker is Professor Michael Krauss, who teaches torts, product liability, legal ethics, legal philosophy, and comparative law at George Mason Law School. He's going to talk about criminal law. He was educated at Carleton. I'm going to botch this pronunciation, but University de Sherbrooke and Yale, and taught law at de Sherbrooke and at the University of Toronto before going to George Mason University Law School, where he received their Teacher of the Year Award in 1994. He's written widely both in legal journals and the mainstream press on tort law. And I understand he will explain to us how the tort law should be profoundly moral. Professor Krauss.
Thank you. Coming up to the podium, Father Sirico expressed the fear that being the only non-lawyer here, he would not have anything to say that would be relevant to what we are saying. I think he will see that that's not the case after I'm done. I do want to focus my comments on tort law as they relate to moral responsibility, and I will answer the question posed, is there still moral responsibility in tort law, at the very end of my remarks. But I have a more ambitious goal, which is to convince you that what ails tort law is a very serious internal disease that cannot be addressed by the cosmetic surgery of so-called tort reform presently. I am going to cogitate in a bit on the nature of tort law. I'm going to try to sketch out two different models of tort law, a moral and an amoral tort law, and I'm going to try to convince you that we have moved from the former to the latter. Let me start, though, by just telling you two little tort stories. They're Midwestern tort stories, as befits our locale. They're separated by about a century, by almost exactly a century, the old and the new, the good and the bad, and I'll try to explain why one's good and one's bad in the bulk of the remainder of my remarks. But first, the stories. The good is Vosburgh v. Putney, an 1893 judgment. By the way, both of these are going to be plaintiff's awards. These are not cases where the plaintiff loses. In Vosburgh, which was a Wisconsin case, one school child, a 12-year-old, kicked a classmate in the shin in the classroom after order had been called. The kicker apparently had every wish to annoy, but no desire to cause any permanent injury. Unbeknownst to him, however, the kickee, the other child, was recovering from an infection in exactly the spot where the contact occurred. The blow reactivated his wound, eventually resulting in permanent impairment. The defendant, the child who kicked, was held liable for the entire injury, despite his total lack of knowledge of the plaintiff's fragility. In an interesting aside, the court suggested that its decision might have been very different had the kick occurred, say, on a playing field during recess. I'll get back to this case, but let me flash forward 100 years to what I'm going to call the bad. Lee versus Chicago Transit, a case from this city, 1993, 100 years after Vosburgh. Mr. Sang Yu Lee was killed when he urinated on the electrified third rail of the Ravenswood L track at the Kedzie Avenue crossing here in Chicago. To get to the tracks, Mr. Lee had to cross a wooden barrier and ignore signs that said danger, electric current, and keep out. Those signs apparently meant little to Mr. Lee, who didn't understand any language other than Korean. But knowing English apparently would not have helped Mr. Lee anyway, because he was so drunk that the autopsy report placed him in the, quote, stupor, unquote, category of intoxication. His widow sued nonetheless, and 14 years later, the Illinois Supreme Court approved the trial court's award of $1.5 million to the widow. I submit that these two tort stories say a lot about the connection of tort law with moral responsibility. And I want to go beyond the journalistic rendition of these two stories to try to show you what's theoretically good about one, what's theoretically bad about the other, and what has made tort law become so ugly, again, that this mere cosmetic surgery won't be enough to fix it. Unfair or undeserved losses occur all the time. Good people get sick and die. Rapists devastate innocent women's lives. People are struck by lightning and die. Two drivers may be involved in a car accident, and they may be equally innocent or equally negligent, yet one emerges spectacularly uninjured while the other one is crippled for life. Kindly merchants may lose their shirt despite their best efforts when a more savvy competitor moves in next door. In each of these cases, the natural victim of the loss may wish that the loss be transferred to another person. Sometimes every legal system transfers these losses, sometimes it doesn't. There are two ways in which these transfers are accomplished in private law, that is to say, through tort and contract. Both tort and contract therefore constrain our liberties, they result in judgments adverse to us, but they do so in very different ways. Let me expand on that very briefly. Contract, obviously, to paraphrase Hobbes, arises from man's realization that total liberty results in a life that is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. From that realization springs the paradox that liberty is morally implemented when it is voluntarily traded away through commitment and through obligation. Though man may not alienate his freedom entirely, he can, and indeed he must, parcel bits of it off if he wishes to partake of a moral life. Contract law, thus, is about voluntary limits on liberty, which are necessary if liberty is to be consummated. Tort law concerns liberty in a different way than contract. Like contract, tort law can only result from a voluntary act. A reflex action will never result in tort liability. Like contract, tort produces legal obligations, condemnations to pay sums of money, for example. But tort differs from contract in that contract concerns acts that are designed to result in losses of liberty. When a contract is concluded, risk has been intentionally purchased and sold, and some obligation deliberately assumed. When a tort is committed, however, the liability-incurring act is not undertaken with the intention of incurring an obligation. Tort liability is therefore independent of meaningful consent. Using a Weberian methodology, a common one, it's possible to sketch out two ideal types of tort law as they relate to these underlying premises. At one pole, we have what I'm going to call a moral tort system. A moral tort system presupposes the technical impossibility and indeed the ethical vileness of attempts to centrally engineer human conduct. The tort tribunal is not a master planner, but an arbiter between citizens who have a disagreement about who should bear a loss that has already occurred. The court must, if it decides to transfer the loss, have a reason for doing so. This reason must be understandable for the parties to the dispute. It must in some deep way appeal to common values, for the court knows that it is incapable of replacing these values with Platonic decrees. This appeal to values is simultaneously an appeal to the intelligence of free and responsible people. It communicates to the losing party that if he learns from experience and if he conforms his behavior to common values, he can lead his life in such a way as to avoid tort liability. In a Kantian sense, this kind of tort law treats parties as ends, capable of moral choice. Indeed, it is this respect for parties' private self-determination that makes this tort system moral. At the other pole of this continuum is a tort system with a very different premise. Tort law is ascribed no necessary moral content and makes no appeal to deeply held values. Rather, tort law is a means of manipulating behavior through commands in an Austinian or Skinnerian fashion, so as to achieve a social optimum which the state agency has identified. This paradigm is, of course, of a constructivist tort law. Parties affected by tort judgments under this paradigm need not accept the court's verdict as legitimate any more than a rat accepts the legitimacy of the structure of its maze. In a Kantian sense, this amoral tort system treats the parties to a lawsuit as a means to some social goal. In classic American, Anglo-American tort law, before the paradigm shift that I'm going to describe, two types of acts could lead to liability. Both types of these actions illustrate the morality of common law tort. On the one hand, individuals were liable for deliberately violating the rights of another. This is the rubric of intentional torts, of which trespass, assault, and battery are the most well known. The underlying propositions of Vosburgh, that was the battery case, the kick in the classroom, are worth fleshing out. Clearly, the Vosburgh court felt that the plaintiff, regardless of the fragility of his leg, retained his right to it. Sitting peacefully in his seat in class, he had given no sign of consent to yield his bodily integrity. His presence on the playing field during recess, on the other hand, might have conveyed an implied authorization to engage in on-the-field roughhousing. Vosburgh symbolizes, I think, the moral content of the law of intentional torts. Individuals are deemed to possess rights that they may relinquish through contract, but these rights may not be traded off by the court. For we should note that the court did not accept a utilitarian defense in Vosburgh. It is frequently argued that the plaintiff, for example, in Vosburgh was the, quote, least cost avoider of the damage, as he alone knew of his injury and he could have stayed home, or he could have worn a special shin brace designed to protect his tender shin from bullies' kicks until the healing was complete. To paraphrase one strain of modern law and economics about which more later, societal wealth might arguably have been maximized if the plaintiff had been incentivized, incited to protect himself with a shin guard, or if he had at least advertised his fragility. If the court had allowed this sort of defense in Vosburgh, it would in a significant way have denied plaintiff's property right in his own leg. Okay, intentional tort has a distinctly moral content, but most tort disputes are not the results of intentional torts. Most collisions, as it were, are accidental. In a legal system based on moral responsibility, who should bear accidental losses? For our purposes, two solutions can be distinguished. One solution, which I claim is divorced from morals, identifies causation as the sole source of liability. It suffices, according to this view, to determine who harmed whom. The author of the harm is then held liable to the sufferer of the harm, even if the author did nothing wrong. Every classical Western tort system, including the Anglo-American common law of tort, holds a different view than this. It holds causation to be necessary but not sufficient as a criterion for unintentional tort liability. It refuses to transfer accidental losses from the natural victim to someone else unless that someone else caused the damage wrongfully. This is, of course, the negligence standard. The strict liability view, which divorces causation from morality, has led to a morally irresponsible tort law through the rise of what I will now call causal nihilism. This transformation of causation is a remarkable and underreported event in Western law. I believe it is a product both of the decline of faith and of the rise of an unrelenting consequentialism. Causal nihilism has reared its head both on the left and on the right. The left, of course, sees root causes of problems, where all causes are social, and where individuals are never causal agents, but merely the unwitting pawns of social forces. The left rejects individual moral choice because individuals just don't count. Parts of the right, notably strains of normative law and economics, also reject classical causation, but for a different reason. It cannot comprehend the objective moral judgments that lie behind causal statements. So, Sir Ronald Coase, for example, in his famous article, The Problem of Social Cost, expressed puzzlement with lawyers' obsession with causation as a moral phenomenon. Causation, he claimed, doesn't objectively exist. Rather, so-called causation is really just bilateral participation in the generation of social costs. So, for example, one must not say that X, driving while drunk, caused pedestrian Y's injury. Rather, one must say that both X and Y were merely in the same place at the same time with wasteful social results, creating a joint cost maximization problem. Similarly, professor, now judge, Guido Calabresi, in a famous article entitled Reflection on Causation in the Law of Torts, argued that a view of cause which assigned moral responsibility after the fact of an accident was totally unhelpful because it was not scientifically rigorous. Calabresi proposed defining cause agnostically as a before-the-fact increase in risk. That is, if an activity increases the chances of a kind of injury, then that activity is a cause of the injury. For example, a bar owner causes the drunk driver's erratic driving because if the bar wasn't there, there would likely be less drunk driving. Thus, holding dram shop owners liable in tort will incite them to exercise control over irresponsible clients. Whereas under classical liberalism, the state is authorized to use coercion to prevent one citizen from causing harm to another, a causally nihilistic state can prevent you from harming by omission, since an omission to help is equally causal as direct harm under this nihilistic proposal. Redefining cause in this way accelerates the transformation of rights from process-oriented negative rights, like the right to be left alone, to result-oriented positive rights, like the right to happiness or the right to good health. Because, of course, the lack of attainment of good health, say, is under causal nihilism exactly equivalent to the direct deprivation of good health through a harmful action. These redefinitions of rights, harm, and cause, I submit, are at the root of tort's moral decay. Recent developments in tort can be understood as a paradigm shift from the moral tort law to the amoral tort law, from a private ordering tort law to the public policy-oriented tort law. Let me offer two brief illustrations of the impact of this shift in two different areas of tort law. First, products liability, which is in the news for obvious reasons. Many products liability suits are, of course, contract and not tort problems. If I think my new car is a lemon, I think that my seller has breached his obligation to deliver the adequate automobile that he told me he would deliver. But a shift in paradigms occurred in a series of judgments in the 1950s and 1960s which denigrated contracts as products of unequal bargaining power, resulting in oppression of weak consumers by strong manufacturers. Public allocation of risk became the alternative to private ordering through contract by substituting liability without fault for contract law. Absolute liability was seen as an instrument with a social purpose to have allegedly wealthy manufacturers purchase allegedly cheap insurance for allegedly poor consumers that were unable to purchase the insurance themselves. I insist on this. Products liability law, since this shift, is now seen to have a social purpose, whereas classical tort and contract, I submit, are non-instrumental. They have no social purpose except to permit private ordering by private individuals. Developments in products liability have been incorrectly called the takeover of contract by tort. Incorrectly, in my view, because, in my view, products liability, today's products liability law is one in which contract has been taken over by a constructivism that is foreign to classical tort. Products liability has become an attempt to implement public ideas about distributive justice rather than an effort to enhance private ordering through corrective justice. The central thrust of products liability today is precisely its indifference to the moral notions of responsibility for wrongful behavior that are intrinsic to tort. Thus transformed, products liability has softened causation requirements in ways advocated by both the left and the right, as I indicated previously, so that no direct moral link between the defendant and the plaintiff's injury need be shown, so long as the defendant is an efficient reducer of risk. This is the case for Lee versus Chicago Transit, my bad case about the third rail in the L. Chicago Transit Authority must be incentivized to take measures preventing illiterates in a drunken stupor from trespassing on its tracks. So Nissan is held liable to the driver injured in the car with no airbag, even though the driver knew that the car had no airbag when he bought the car, because it is necessary to incentivize Nissan to provide airbags to all drivers, which will reduce the per unit cost of airbags through diminishing marginal costs. So the distributor of alcohol is liable when an adult abuses the product that he has sold and runs a third party down, according to approximately 30 states' statutes. So, most recently, manufacturers of cigarettes are alleged to be liable to states for the medical care of people who have chosen to use tobacco, according to statutes in Florida and six other states. This is all part of the new tort law, civil liability by statute, and despite any lack of causation. Second illustration is a little less obvious. A second illustration of the new tort is a bit less obvious, and it is the decline of private wrongfulness. Interestingly, as tort law has become identified with public policy, its ability to address private wrongs has decreased. For to declare behavior wrong is to declare that there are standards of behavior. And in an age when all standards are supposed to come from the legislature and none from the Almighty or from our cultural tradition, judges are reluctant to call anything that's not illegal wrong. A striking illustration of this can be found in the decline of the tort of libel. One of our founding fathers wrote, "Every man has a right to use of the press just as he has a right to use of his firearms. But he who commits libel abuses his privilege just as unquestionably as if he were to plunge his sword into the bosom of a fellow citizen. This quote translates the quintessence of torts as private ordering. But in 1983, Hustler magazine published an article in which the Reverend Jerry Falwell was portrayed as involved in a drunken, incestuous relationship with his mother. "I think I have never been as angry as I was at that moment," said Reverend Falwell, describing his reaction on seeing the article. "In all my life, I had never believed that human beings could do something like this," end quote. At trial, Hustler publisher Larry Flint admitted that he was trying to, quote, "assassinate the integrity," unquote, of Falwell. Yet the United States Supreme Court ruled that no actionable injury had taken place. One is reminded of the famous F the Draft case in the 1970s, where Justice Harlan wrote for the Supreme Court, "One man's vulgarity is another man's lyric." Our courts are increasingly reluctant to admit the possibility of private wrongs unless these wrongs have been declared criminal through public ordering. This moral positivism has threatened to destroy private ordering, and with it tears out the heart of tort law. Please indulge me in conclusion as I contend that Mr. William Jefferson Clinton and people like him are intellectually linked to the decline of moral responsibility in tort. I'm not talking about alleged torts committed by William Jefferson Clinton, but I am talking about intellectually linked. In America's first postmodern inauguration speech in January 1993, President Clinton spoke of the urgent need to, quote, define what it means to be an American, unquote. Each generation of Americans, he said, must, presumably through the federal government, redefine what it means to be an American. As you all know, the President and the First Lady have consistently emphasized this politics of meaning. America means what our political representatives say it means. Similarly, criminal law and civil liability mean what our democratic institutions acting in the public welfare, in the public domain, say that they mean. Legal philosophers here present will recognize the debt that this statement by our chief executive owes to critical legal studies, liberation of judges from the constraints of text and from natural law. People with power determine under this view as opposed to discover meaning. President Clinton is as wrong about the meaning of America as the crits, critical legal studies, are wrong about the meaning of legal texts. For what it means to be an American is not redefined each generation or each election. It has an objective meaning provided for us by our founders. We are, I submit, a creedal nation defined by basic and permanent philosophic affirmations. These include the idea that individuals are responsible for their own happiness, that they have natural rights essential to the pursuit of this happiness, and that government must protect these natural private rights. This credo preserves an intrinsic place for private ordering in America, and tort law, which is one of the two pillars of private ordering with contract, is therefore an intrinsic part of the American credo. But this credo is now sneered at. To answer the panel's question, modern tort law is both devoid of and hostile to moral responsibility. Tort reform will not rescue us from this fate until it reasserts our credo. Until they understand this, all of Dole's statutes and all Gingrich's men will not put tort law back together again. Thank you.
Dole's statues and Gingrich's men, although I'll have to ask you at some stage if I was correct in thinking that you were saying that Guido Calabresi was on the right, but thanks very much for a very interesting talk, and to